Jack.
You're the first one, Jack, so we're just waiting for somebody else to come on.
Sure. No problem. It's picking up.
I'm sorry?
The zip is picking up.
Hello.
Good evening.
Hello.
So we can begin.
Okay. Anybody else on?
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay. Thank you for waiting for me. I get busy doing things and then I'll look up and, oh, pass on. Hurry, hurry.
Not a problem. So the handout is available on the Revealed Wisdom Matrix in row 11. The second column from the left is Advanced Reincarnations. When that landing page opens up, scroll down to class 25A. And that will open up to chapter 22, section 6. The title of where we are beginning is Sins and Their Reincarnations.
All right, you got to give me
Would you repeat the title, please? Because that's not what I had.
I will. Okay. Sins and Their Reincarnations, chapter 22, section 6.
Okay. First of all, going back, I wasn't at a computer. Revealed Wisdom, and then
Revealed Wisdom, scroll down to the matrix.
Yes.
In row 11.
Yes.
The second column from the left. It says Advanced Reincarnations. Click on that.
Yeah.
When that opens up, scroll down.
Malcolm.
Good evening, Malcolm. We're just announcing the handout.
I'm going to mute because I realized I did the handout, but it's in the other room, so I have to go get it. So I'm going to mute for a while.
All right. So I'll begin over with the handouts. It's on the Revealed Wisdom Matrix, row 11.
Yeah.
Second column from the left. Click on that to get the handout, the landing page for Advanced Reincarnations. Then scroll down to class 25, which is about 3 inches down from the top. Class 25.
Go ahead.
Scroll down to to where it says class 25 and then the section of handout under class 25.
Yep.
And you're going to handout for class 25A. And that's where we will begin.
Chapter 22, section 6.
Correct.
Okay.
Sins and the reincarnations. Then I'll start with the L'shem Yichud. L'shem Yichud Kud Shabariku Ishkinte Bit Kilur Himud Hilu Kilur Hib. Liakta L'shem Yudhe Bavate Biyehuda Shalim Israel. Limud Torah Mitzvah La Sok Torah Mitzvah. Vahino Amadunai Eloheinu Alein Seya Dena Perenei Aleinu Maseya Dena Perenehu. One who speaks Lashon Hara, evil speech, or the similar, will reincarnate into a stone, which cannot speak. And as we have said in the preceding section, regarding Naval HaKarmeli, since the opposite of speaking is silence. Someone who feeds improperly slaughtered meat, in Hebrew the word is nevela, to a Jew comes back as a leaf on a tree, the level of vegetation. The wind blowing him back and forth will never allow him rest, and this will be his punishment. When his time is over, the leaf will become detached from the tree. Wither, in Hebrew the word is novellet, and fall to the ground. This is an example of a real death for him, one who was cut off and uprooted from the world. This is an unwritten commentary, but you begin to see how the reincarnations are measure for measure. What you do wrong, you then have to experience the reincarnation in an environment that causes you the same harm that you did to someone else. And this is called measure for measure. Continuing to read. Someone who feeds improperly slaughtered meat. I read that, I'm sorry. Sometimes the withered leaf can return as another leaf, which will also wither. And this is the secret of the verse, the leaf will wither, which is part of a verse of the prophecy of Jeremiah. Since one who feeds nevela to a Jew reincarnates into a leaf that withers and falls to the ground. This is also the secret of the verse, you will be like an elm tree with withered leaves. This is a prophecy in Isaiah. Because sometimes the withered leaf can return as another leaf, which will wither, even many times, as in the case of a person who has to reincarnate many times in this world to receive his specified punishment. And this is also an unwritten commentary. Always remember that when you read the word punishment, it's really a translation error. It should be cause rather than punishment. Because it's not punishment and reward, it's cause and effect.
You need this?
Mm-hmm. Okay. You have a
Hello,
good
I'd
week.
Like to ask a question.
Go ahead, Hannah.
Okay. This thought came to me. I'm glad I'm past the point of being able to rake leaves. But if we're raking leaves and the rake, I mean, it could be causing pain to those leaves. And if there's a reincarnated soul there, then we're contributing to their pain, are we?
Well, first off, if you're raking the leaves, they're on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And which means they've already withered and dropped off the tree. And so that has already been defined as a death. So the soul does not feel something in the physical world after death. It does feel, it does go through the effect of being in Gehinnom. But we're not, if you're raking the leaf from the ground, there's no pain being felt by the soul, because when the soul, the leaf hits the ground, it is effectively grounding the physicality, and the soul is released. Now, as a child, many of us, and I sometimes find myself still doing it, picking a leaf off a tree as you walk by a bush on the street. That could be where you are causing the damage to the soul, causing pain to the soul. But it's not every leaf has a human soul in it.
Mm-hmm.
And number one, but the fact that you chose that particular leaf is a tikkun between you and whatever essence is in that leaf, whether it's human or it's something else. If you shorten its lifespan, so to speak, then it has to come back and reincarnate into another leaf to experience what it needs to experience to cleanse measure for measure what it has had done as a human being. Again, I'm not sure I'm being clear in my language, but I hope I am.
Yes, you are. Thank you.
I'm continuing to read. Some people reincarnate into water, which is considered on the level of vegetation, as we mentioned previously. This can happen to a person who spills blood in this world, and you can remember this from "You will spill it, blood on the ground like water." This is a verse in Deuteronomy. It also says, "One who spills the blood of another, his blood will be spilled," meaning that he will be placed under a flow of water that will pour on him constantly. He will want to get up and stand, but the water will constantly pour on him, and he will find no relief, constantly rotating in circles under the flow of water. Anyone meant to die by strangulation will reincarnate into water. This is hinted to in the verse, "We will all die like water flowing along the ground that connects, shall we be collected." As well, anyone meant to die by strangulation, but who was not punished by a torch, will reincarnate into water, and so be strangled every moment. One who commits adultery with a married woman, and who is therefore punishable by strangulation, will reincarnate into a grinding stone, into which wheat is placed, and which uses water to grind. That is where the man and woman will be judged, in the secret of, "For another, my wife will be ground." This is a verse from Job. The word "grinding" is used here as a euphemism for marital relations. One who is not scrupulous with the washing of the hands before eating bread will reincarnate into water. This is the secret of the verse, "Then they would have surged across our soul, the treacherous waters. Blessed is God, who did not present us as prey for their teeth." The headliners of Nishayanan Anu, Teref Lishen Ahem, did not present us as prey for their teeth, spells the word natilat, which means to wash, as we say in the blessing, natilat yadayim, washing of the hands. We must thank God that we, unlike the wicked, wash our hands. This is the secret of what the sages say. One who eats without washing his hands is uprooted from the world and is judged with water. There is a hint to this from Blessed is God, thank you, who did not present us as prey for their teeth, whose head letters spell the word natilat. By washing one's hands, one is not given as prey for their teeth, that is, of the surging waters. Therefore, we must thank God that we, unlike the wicked, wash our hands. And it's important to realize that when we wash hands, we don't wash hands with running water. We wash hands with water that has been put into a vessel. Traditionally, we use a two-handed vessel, but we can use one as we've talked at other times. But the reason for the water being in a vessel is hinted at in this paragraph. One who does not recite blessings in advance of enjoying something, treating them with no respect, or steals from his father or mother, or befriends a destructive person, also reincarnates into water. Some reincarnate into animals. A community leader who lords himself over others reincarnates into a bee. As Rabbi Nachman Bar Yitzchak said, pride does not suit women. Two women were proud, and the names of both were not positive. One was called B, the Hebrew word for bee, and the other was called the Hebrew word for weasel. He was referring to Deborah the prophetess, who lorded herself over Barak when she sent for him and did not go to him herself. The other was Huldah, the prophetess who insulted Josiah, the king, when she said, "Speak to the man," as opposed to "speak to the king." As the sages say, from their words you can see that Deborah was a proud woman, and therefore she didn't perform any work and was very talkative, never remaining silent. Therefore, a leader who lords himself over the community and one who speaks improperly comes back as a bee who have these two traits. That's the end of the section. Does anybody have any questions?
Yeah, this is Jack. I do.
Go ahead, Jack.
Okay. So I think of a lot of these things as coming from Leviticus, these punishments. But here it's all over the Torah and the commentaries. Is that right?
It's actually not the commentary. It's the source of what we're reading. When you see it in bold, that's coming from the writings of Rabbi the Ari, Rabbi Isaac Luria. And his writings are taken as gospel by the Kabbalah. But without going into the meaning of gospel, he is bringing sources from all throughout the Tanakh, from the prophets, from the writings, from the Torah itself, from the five books also. He's bringing these sources to demonstrate how all of these the writings in the Tanakh have spiritual spiritual information and spiritual laws being revealed. That's why he gives us the sources, or that's what we can take from these sources. Your
okay.
thought that Leviticus is the source because you perceive reading Leviticus at a ritual level, at a literal level, you're seeing Leviticus as this, actually the way the Western world sees it, as this harsh, judgmental God who gives out these punishments. This is an incorrect way to perceive Leviticus. Leviticus is actually the laws associated with the Kohanim, with the priests. And it's relating the idea that we have levels of hierarchy within Judaism. And this hierarchy, one of the hierarchies, is described by the concept of an Israeli, the majority of the children of Israel, the Levites, who are on a higher level, and a more higher level meaning having more kedusha, more holiness, and that they can work in the temple, which is a place of holiness, a place that is closer to God. And the highest level being that of the priests, the Kohanim. And we understand that as someone elevates spiritually, the scale of justice is more defined and more narrow, so that in the case of these prophetesses, Huldah and Deborah, if you know their stories, a normal Israeli, a woman who doesn't go to her husband but expects her husband to come to her, does not receive that level of justice. She's not evaluated as doing something wrong. But on the level of a prophetess, having her do that, she is saying that Malchut, the manifestation level, is more important spiritually, is on a higher level, or at least an equal level, to the spiritual level of Zeranpin. Now, again, I always do this in this class, but it's the nature of the class and the questions that everyone asks, which are always excellent. And your question, Jack, is excellent. But to understand, we cannot accept the literal understandings from the Western world because they're not correct. And that's what these teachings and why I teach these advanced reincarnation classes, it helps to break the klipa that tells us we need to understand things on a literal level. But that's not the way to understand it. It's not the way the Torah was meant to be understood. And I'm quoting, or I'm paraphrasing the Zohar, when it says that the people who read the Torah literally are fools. So I hope I was answered your question, even if it's not yet.
Very much. No, it's fine. No, it's a good answer. And makes sense.
I know another meaning of Devon.
Go ahead.
Another meaning of Deborah, this congregation. What came to me is speak festively. Maybe I'm wanting to take up for the women because I'm a woman. But also with Huldah, she and her husband were the ones who took Josiah when he was just a baby and saved him from being killed and hid him. And I'm wondering if, you know, when she called a man, she was thinking of I would think that they felt like they were raising him and hiding him from harm. They looked upon him as their own child, and maybe her words speak to the man may have come from that relationship with the child as a child. I don't know.
Yes,
Hannah,
you're absolutely correct. At the level of an Israeli, at the level of most of the children of Israel, that statement would have been fine, because as you raise a child, we all think of our children as children, even if they're adults.
Mm-hmm.
But at the level of a prophetess, she is already elevated above the level that is normally associated with the Israeli. She's moved out of Malchut and into Zeranpin. And for her to say that this is the same as the child she raised, which is what she's saying when she says, speak to the man, she needs to recognize that this has now been chosen by God to be a king. It's not something that just happened, that the child was born and he is the descendant of someone who was king of Israel. That soul was chosen to become a king in Israel. And she didn't recognize that. And that's the scales of justice. For you and I, they wouldn't even question those words. But for her, she needed to realize that. But for whatever reason, she wasn't thinking about it. She didn't have that consciousness that was detracting from the honor that the king is due. And if you detract from the honor of another human being, what will you do with respect to detracting from the honor of Hashem? That's the consciousness that the Mida keneged mida, measure for measure, is involved with this. Mm-hmm. And it's always relative. We always have to remember, like the last week when we spoke about this, it's always relative to the soul involved, which means it's relative to the level of consciousness that soul has achieved.
Mm-hmm. Also, when the king found the book of Deuteronomy and wanted to know if it really was a legitimate scroll, he went to her rather than to Jeremiah. You know, so
correct.
I don't know. I see the scale. Yeah. I don't know why I feel like I have to defend them both, but I feel like maybe their souls need elevating right now to a more positive.
Well, if we take a look at the full story, if we take a look at the full story of Deborah, Devorah, and how she gave Barak an opportunity, he had come to her at her tree, meaning he had come to her as she was connecting to the tree of life. He had come to her to describe this problem, and she gave him directions. She said, go get so many men and go out to war. And he said, I can't without you. Saying she was connected to the tree of life. She was giving prophecy. She was telling him what he needed to do. And he changed it. He didn't accept it. Now, he's not on the level of Moshe, who argued with God. Barak wasn't even a prophet. He was married to Deborah. This was a husband and wife talking to each other. But at a time when she was connected to prophecy, connected to the tree of life, which is the code word that describes that she's sitting under her tree. Now, I know Hannah's familiar with the with the Bible and Jack is not. So I'm just trying to bring it all into perspective.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe she did teshuva.
And if she did teshuva, she didn't have to reincarnate as a devorah, mm-hmm. which is the Hebrew word for bee, or the shoresh of it, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
Well, I think because he's got a reputation of not being a bright man, and she sent him to learn how to make wicks for the Abdallah candles, and he began to be associated with the temple and all, and he grew. Maybe that was her teshuva. And I'm going to leave them both alone. Hopefully that raised them today, at least in my mind.
I understand it. And your questions and your comments are always good. Don't stop. It's all part of the growth of all of us.
I think we all made the mark somewhere along the way. And I hate to be judged on one area when you've had so many pluses on your side rather than minuses. And I think both of those women at the time that they lived, I mean, she was, well, we know Huldah, the gates on that side of the temple are named after the gates of Huldah, and that she actually had a school. She taught Torah, and for a woman to be able to do that at that time, she had to have an elevated soul. So anyway, she means a lot to me.
But that's the point.
And
Hannah, that's the point. She had an elevated soul, but mm-hmm. she was so therefore judged in a more narrow pattern. It's like your adult daughter tells you that the way you cook is not right anymore. It's time to use a crock pot instead of a frying pan. I'm making this up because I don't cook, as you know. But I'm giving it trying to give you an example. Now, your daughter comes to you and says that. Are you offended? Or do you evaluate your daughter as she's young and she still needs to learn? We look at people differently. What the Torah is trying to say to us is use your intuition so that when you evaluate people, you're evaluating it from their inner level, not from their outer level. Yes, they are both, Huldah and Devorah are high souls. You don't become a prophet without being a high soul, elevated. But still, because you're elevated means you have greater responsibility. Yeah. And that's why the judgment is more narrow, more strict. And that's why we have different levels of halakha. You have halakha that is lenient, and you have halakha that is strict. Who does it apply to? You have to evaluate that. You have to make those decisions for yourself, about yourself. Jack, I think you were about to say something when Hannah started.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Hi, Hannah.
Hi.
Hi, Anna. Hi.
Hi.
Anyway.
I'm sorry I didn't hear you if you were,
okay.
And it's sometimes hard to just jump.
Yeah, there's some background noise.
You started. There's background notice, and you did start. You didn't interrupt, Jack.
Okay, good.
I was able to hear.
I understand. No, I
because I don't want to be like Deborah. That's a joke.
So the point I wanted to make is that all of these things seem like a way to make each action in the world holy, for the blessing over the threat or whatever it might be as a way to elevate. Is a way to elevate into a more holy way of doing things.
I wouldn't use the word holy in this respect, but yes, you are right. The words that I would use is you say a blessing on a mundane thing like eating in order to elevate your consciousness, in order to elevate the sparks that are present in the bread or the food that you're eating. Because we are in this world to do tikkun, to make correction. Another way of thinking of tikkun is elevating the sparks that fell from the creation of the of earlier worlds where the Sephiroth broke and broke into pieces, and those pieces fell into the klipot, fell into the physical world. And we are in this world to elevate those sparks back to where they belong within the Sephiroth. So we can call it doing it to, for the sake of holiness, and that's a correct way of thinking about it. Or we can think about it as elevating the sparks. That's also a correct way of thinking about it. And the essence is we do these actions to draw the sparks to our souls so that they will, those sparks of light remain with us through, until certain parts of the year where they can elevate to higher levels of consciousness from the food that was an animal to a human to the spiritual level that happens at night when we go at elevate and study Torah in Shemayim, in the heaven, or from the grains that we eat that are elevated to animals and then to us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's different ways of thinking about it, but you're absolutely right, Jack. You say a blessing for the purpose of raising holiness. But as I said at the beginning, I wouldn't use holiness in that context because holiness is something that really is difficult to define. If you ask somebody what is holiness, they have great difficulty in understanding it and defining it. But
well, it's raising our holiness, right?
That is correct. It's raising our consciousness. The greater our consciousness, the more holiness. I was reading an essay by I don't want to say a concept. There's a machloket, an argument for searching for truth between the Kabbalist or the mystical approach to the world or the rational approach to the world that's represented by Maimonides. And the discussion was about exactly about holiness. Is Jerusalem holy? Both sides say Jerusalem is holy. The Kabbalists say Jerusalem is holy because intrinsically that location is holy. It's not something that gets added to it by human behavior. It was holy at creation. It remains holy. It can only become sullied by human behavior or cleansed of that sulliness by human behavior. The rationalists say that the spot only becomes holy by what happened throughout history at that spot. And so, because Isaac was sacrificed, the binding of Isaac took place on the Temple Mount, and the temples were built on the Temple Mount. Each of those human activities caused an elevation of holiness in that spot. The Kabbalists would say, that's historical events. That's not a reason for the increase of holiness. Now, I realize that that's, this whole discussion is not something that most of my students will find important. But ultimately, the search for truth is important. So what is holiness? And it is literally an exchange of energy between two entities, two essences. And that exchange of energy must work in both directions. That's what makes holiness. That's how you define holiness. Which is why I said I wouldn't use holiness to talk in terms of saying a blessing over bread. Should I go on or
why not?
Have I
why not? Wait. Why?
That's why I said,
Isn't a blessing? Why isn't a blessing over bread an exchange?
It is an exchange, but it's more of an activation of the energy. The chewing of the food, the swallowing, the descent in the esophagus, the acid in your stomach that breaks down the food, separates it into mundane and holy. That process is holiness. The blessing by itself is not. It's part of that same process, but it's not complete. If your intent is to make $1 million, but you don't get out of bed in the morning to do anything to make the $1 million, is the intent sufficient? Can you say, I made $1 million because I intended to do it? But it's the same thing here. My intent by saying the blessing is to elevate the sparks. Or my intent by saying the blessing is to start the process of creating holiness. But I have to complete it.
Right. Well, my understanding in Judaism is that, you can't just make a wish. You have to, or a prayer. You have to take the action to make it complete.
That is correct. Except when you are prevented from taking the action. And we are taught the sons of Korah who fell into the pit by the earthquake where the earth swallowed them. They didn't die. They did teshuvah on the way down to hell, God forbid. And so they didn't have the time. They were prevented from doing teshuvah. Therefore, they were still granted teshuvah because they had the thought, the intention to do teshuvah. So it's always relative to the situation. So yes, Judaism teaches you have to do an action. But if you go to a mikveh in the morning before you pray, for example, you had relations with your wife, which means that you need to go to the mikveh to cleanse the impurity of the leftover sperm. You go to the mikveh and the door is locked. You did the mikveh. Your impurity is released from it. It's cleansed. But you didn't do the action.
Okay.
So you have to think about the whole process, not just each individual part.
Okay.
Section, chapter 22, section 7. Bet Din, enforcers and other incarnations. Bet Din means a court, spiritual court. Regarding these types of Gilgulim, reincarnations, or any soul that is judged in the heavenly court, someone goes before him continuously, announcing his reincarnation, or his the effect, never leaving him. There is also one enforcer assigned to him, punishing him as is fitting. For example, in the case of one who reincarnates into water, the enforcer stands over him continuously, constantly lowering him into the water for the duration of the allotted time. The enforcer stands over him continuously, constantly lowering him into the water for the duration of allotted time. And for, if you've not heard this before, I will say it again because it does need to be said. We frequently see where the Ari has included these thoughts twice or multiple times. And there's a reason for that. It's breaking the klipa that is not broken the first time you read it. As well for the majority of reincarnations or punishments mentioned, there is a court before him during the period of the Gilgul or punishment, judging him, changing his punishment from time to time according to what is fitting for him. Shmuel said, Shmuel is the son of Rabbi Chaim Vital, who was the student of the Ari. The Ari taught verbally. Rabbi Chaim Vital wrote it down, and he was assisted by his son, Shmuel. Shmuel said, I found another collection of writings of those close to the Arizal, and even though within them are words of the Rav, it seems that they are not from the mouth of my teacher, the Rav, the great feeder of all. As he, the author, wrote, nevertheless, I will present them. This is what I found in the book of HaRav Eliezer HaLevi, though in my humble opinion, without doubt, they are not from my teacher, meaning the Ari. One who has relations with an animal reincarnates as a bat. One who has relations with a nita, a menstruant, reincarnates into a female Gentile. With a married woman, into a male donkey. With his mother, into a female donkey. One who commits homosexuality reincarnates into a coney or a rabbit, depending on whether he was the one committing the act or to whom it occurred. One who has relations with his daughter-in-law reincarnates into a mule, with a non-Jew into a female Jewish prostitute, with one stepmother into a camel, with one sister-in-law, his brother's wife, into a male mule, with one sister through his father or his mother into a chasida, a stork, and his companions will kill him. This is the secret of the verse. If a man takes his sister through his father or his mother, it is a chesed. The word chesed is the shoresh for the word chasida. And chasida means a stork. And the nature of a stork is they mate for life. They're very sharing birds in that they will raise the children of other storks. They will sit on the eggs of other storks, but not other creatures, other birds, only the Chassidah. Yes, the plural of Chassidah. It is the same for one who has relations, excuse me, with his mother-in-law. One who constantly looks at those forbidden to him and gazes at them will reincarnate into a white vulture. This is a code word sentence having to do with pornography. One who lies with a domesticated animal, a wild animal, or a bird, reincarnates as a raven. One who constantly looks at those forbidden to him and gazes at them will reincarnate into Re'ah, a white vulture, who can Ro'eh, see, the farthest of all the birds. All of this is only when he has not done Teshuvah. Shmuel said, this is the correct location for another introduction that I already wrote about in Sha'ar Mamre, Chazal regarding the reward for the righteous, and Chibut HaKever, the fire, the beating in the grave, the cleansing in the grave. That's the end of the section. Are there any questions?
Well, I see now why we see the stork as a symbol of babies.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You'll find
I have a question.
All of these, let me finish one thought, Jack, and then you can. All of these descriptions of reincarnations into various animals or events, you have to look at what we are so far from today, being not close to the farm, not close to these animals. We don't really normally, most people do not understand the nature, the way the animals behave. And if we understood that, we would understand more of the measure for measure involved. Go ahead, Jack.
Why do so many of these seem very harsh?
Number one, to me, they're not harsh. But I do appreciate that from your perspective, not just you, but most people, they sound harsh. But are they really harsh? If you understand the concept of measure for measure, it's not harsh. It's justice. It's balancing the world. Let's take an example, a very harsh example, of a person who shoots another person. And he kills that other person. How do you balance that? Most people would say you can't balance it. You can't undo it because the person's dead and he can't come back to life. But he does come back to life. He comes back in another reincarnation. So it's not like these harsh things are the end. They're part of a cleansing. Just like a common cold is a cleansing of some action that you've done. All illness, all effects of reincarnation is cleansing. If you didn't go through these kinds of reincarnations, you could never return to the endless world. And the system is set up so you will return to the endless world. But that can only be when you are in balance. And you can only become in balance when you cleanse the negative actions you've done. So is it harsh? Let's still go back. Did the actions you do, the actions you did, they are harsh. Therefore, they require harsh consequences. But in reality, Hashem shows you mercy. As an example, the leaf falls from the tree, but you didn't spend enough time before the wind came and blew it off. So you have to reincarnate into another leaf until your time is sufficient to cleanse what needs to be cleansed. Because the goal is to return to the endless world, not looking at this part of the process.
I'm not arguing about a man who has, I'm not arguing about a man who has relations with his sister or mother-in-law or something like that, okay? That's bad stuff. But failure to wash your hands sends you back as water. That's pretty bad.
No, because, again, you're looking at the person who washes his hands improperly is saying, God gave us this mitzvah, and I'm choosing not to pay attention. You're rebelling against God. That's a pretty harsh thing to do. Now, in our Western world today,
everything bad you do is that. Is like that. Everything bad you do is like that.
Yes, but then it's relative to the soul and the society that you live in. So in our physical world today, if I was raised in the Muslim world, born in Palestine, I would be taught that it's a mitzvah to kill. It's always relative to the soul involved, to the culture that that soul is living in this lifetime, and how they relate to all of that. All of us need to understand that we have been inculcated by the society in which we live. But the Torah is written for every society. And when we arrive at the Garden of Eden again, we will be able to see the past lifetimes and the cleansings that we went through that allowed us to arrive at the Garden of Eden to wait for all of the other people who have not yet achieved their tikkun. To me, the world is perfectly just. I accept my responsibility for where I am in this world. And as my students know, I was once very wealthy on a physical level, but not wealthy spiritually. I had to lose that wealth in order to grow in my spiritual path and become the person that I was supposed to be, the person who is named Hanoch, who is to teach Kabbalah. So for me, being in the situation that I'm in is not a problem. I understand it as cleansing and beneficial to my soul. But not everybody does understand that. But not everybody is in the same process. It just looks on a physical level like we're all doing the same thing, but we're not. Each of us is doing what is right for our souls at this moment. And that's why I can make the statement that this world is perfectly just.
Okay.
we are at the end of our hour, so I wish you all a beautiful week, Shavuot Tov. Remind you that there are three classes tomorrow, one in the morning at 7 a.m. Pacific time, studying Psalms for the Tanit Dibur, the fast of words that we do to correct sexual improprieties, to do teshuvah for sexual improprieties that we may have done in a previous lifetime or in this lifetime. That the 4:30 Deep Zohar class, we're in the Parasha of Lech Lecha, and we're starting section 16 Monday night. And at 7 o'clock, we will have a deep class, the writings of the Ari on the Parasha of Vayera. Shavuot Tov to all. Shalom Gadol to all.
Shavuot Tov. Thank you. Glad to meet you, Jack, and the other friends.
Shalom to all. I think Jack is out now. Shalom all.